We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Diane with EdWeb, and it's my honor to introduce our presentation today with the Congressional Medal of Honor Society. I'm here with Kathy Metcalf, who you see there, Executive Director of Education for the Society, and our honored guest Medal of Honor recipient, Lieutenant Colonel William D. Swenson, who received the medal for his service in the U.S. Army in Afghanistan, and who unfortunately is not able to join us by video today, but he has graciously called in to do this interview for you all. And Kathy, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Thank you, Diane, and thank you, Will, for joining us today. I'd like to let our audience know that Captain Swenson is still active duty, correct, Will? And are you okay with me calling you Will on here?
Absolutely. I'm still active duty, still slogging away with DOD.
Very good. I truly appreciate you taking the time to do this with us, and I'm sorry about the camera situation, but we'll do the best we can with what we're doing. Our audience is made up today mainly of teachers who have logged on from all over the country. We have quite a few from middle schools and high schools and a variety of other viewers. The audience intended for this webinar is generally teachers of middle and high school students and their classes. But right now, between COVID and the time of the year, I'm not sure how many classes we actually have on. And I'm hoping that people will let us know in the chat if we actually have students with us. So we gear this towards students. And the idea for me as the interviewer is to really aim the questions that you get toward the kinds of things that students have asked. So we may get questions in today from people who are not educationally focused, but we really want to aim at the high school, middle school age group with the focus on the Medal of Honor values. And as you know, I'm going to give our audience a little background here. The values, for those of you who are not regular watchers of EdWeb interviews for the Medal of Honor, the Medal of Honor values that we use in the character development program are courage, commitment, sacrifice, integrity, citizenship, and patriotism. And I also know that many of you at your schools use respect and leadership, things like that. And today I'll be asking Will to talk a little bit about some of those things as well. And in fact, Will, whatever you want to talk about, really. But I'd first like to have the audience have an opportunity to get to know you a little bit. We do not have a Medal of Honor Society recorded interview that I can refer students to yet, but they can, of course, read your citation online and they can see your White House ceremony online. Would you be willing to tell us a little about Will Swenson pre the Medal of Honor? Where'd you grow up and what kinds of things were you involved in when you were our audience's age, you know, middle and high school?
Well, first off, a warm hello to all of our educators. I appreciate everything that you guys are doing in these very strange times. I have a preschooler and a kindergartner who are now glued to their iPads doing their school, and it's somehow working. Even though it's the apocalypse, they're still being educated, so I appreciate all your hard work. It's interesting times. Well, so I'm Lieutenant Colonel William Swenson. I'm in the United States Army. Currently, I work overseas in an attaché billet. It's somewhat like the State Department for DOD. It's been a very interesting career, 18 years in thus far, and I've enjoyed quite a few moments of it, experienced quite a few interesting locations, careers, and met some wonderful people. But one of the strongest components that I've found about the military that most people don't realize is our core commitment to education. Obviously, to come into the military, there is a degree of educational attainment that's necessary, especially on the officer side. And we have the military academies as well as the ROTC programs that are conduits into being commissioned. But after that, every step of the way, education is an important component of our process forward. So my respect continues even today in my professional capacity. My youth, I actually had two parents who were also educators. They were both professors. So lifelong learning has been a strong component of what I have had in my life, and I'm trying to pass it on to my two little people, even though it's by Zoom at this point. So again, my most profound respect, because these are interesting times. When it comes to education, I see no higher value for our nation than to educate the next generation to be even better citizens than the ones that we are today. I do believe that we educators are the bedrock of everything that we have as a country, and that in the absence of education, we will not be a truly wonderful nation. So what you do is the most critical component of who we are, in my opinion. And from that, I will move on back to Kathy.
Well, in one of the interviews that is available on TV, your interview with, or on TV, I'm sorry, online, with the Pritzker Military Library, you were talking primarily to, I believe, ROTC students, but you mentioned to them education, and when one of them asked you what is most important, you mentioned even within the service itself that continuing education and training were important. Do you want to speak a little bit to the value of training as a continuation of education?
Well, obviously training really doesn't matter which industry you're in. I see education as the foundational stone. It's the cornerstone of your development. But training hones the edge. Training is what's required for you to keep sharp and continue to be at the top of your professional capabilities. So in training in the military, obviously, depending upon where you are in the military, that's everything from marksmanship up to our coders who are making sure that rockets launch on time and in the right direction. And that training is what keeps them sharp. It's what keeps them effective. And that translates into every single industry. In the absence of training, we do lose our edge. However, you do still need that core component, which is that education. Again, in the military, the further you progress through the military, the expectation is at some point that if you want to be a general, you probably need a PhD these days. Most people don't realize that, but that's one of the most effective tools to achieving a 4-star rank is through educational attainment.
Very interesting. That's a great point. I think that most people don't know that. May I ask what disciplines your parents taught in?
Mathematics and English. So I can barely speak English and I cannot add beyond my 10 fingers.
Well, that seems to be how things go generally with parents and kids from what I can see. I also taught English, and I remember when the youngest of my three children was applying to college, she had her school English teacher read her application letters and wouldn't let me touch them. So there you go. I can sympathize with your mother. What about your kids? Do you have any educational aspirations for them?
Well, at this point, they're little, so it's a matter of survival. It's a matter of understanding how to keep a kid in front of a screen from 8:30 to 2:45 every single day. Complicated. I think the most important thing with education is that it should be fun. You should always enjoy what they're doing. They should always have just interest in the subjects that they're learning. Learning has to be engaging and fun. Now, obviously, not every subject can be dinosaurs like it is for the 5-year-old right now, but having that at the beginning, understanding that education is fun, it's not punitive, it's not punishment, it's not a chore, it's something that you should really embrace. I think that comes down to the educators. It comes down to the teachers. And we're very fortunate that our kids just absolutely love their school and they love their teachers, and the teachers are fantastic. And even by Zoom, that connection still remains. It really is up to the educator to be able to identify and connect with those students to give them that, because the parents obviously have a responsibility as well in ensuring that their children are being educated. And that's one of the key components is the parents, obviously. It's their responsibility. But the teachers, it's their connection. It's that human connection with the student that really passes on that lifelong learning passion. I had teachers that I remember, my teachers back to the first grade. I can still name them. I still fundamentally know where they have gone in life. It's about connecting with your students.
You know, in one of the interviews that I watched with you, you talked about leadership and how there are, you know, you can, there are born leaders and the Army works on training leaders, that you can also train leaders. But you talked about leadership in the sense that if a true leader, people want to follow. You don't have to tell them to follow, you want to follow. And I think that that parallels with what you're saying about education right now, that someone who truly loves teaching and is enthusiastic about his or her discipline can inspire that same kind of following that a leader can follow. Related to that, what was your own favorite subject in school?
I think like most children, there's always that shift through what they're fascinated by. Right now, it's ichthyosauruses and parasaurosophiluses, which I've had to learn all over again. But I think that they were probably my obsession at 5 years old as well. Right. I really did find fascinating history. I always found the past and how it connects to today as something that I really enjoyed. And I think that came through my mother. She loved Shakespeare. She loved Greek myths. She loved history. And I think through that, I saw that the power of these stories that were true were just as fantastic as anything that could be invented in somebody's imagination. And so history really took hold. I really enjoyed the parallels between the past and the present and the stories that you could learn from.
Did you have a favorite period of history at all when you were studying it?
Shifting. I really do think that the period in time, the BCs, I find it much more interesting with the Romans and going all the way back to Catul Hayuk. I just think that that period of time is fascinating just because it's more opaque. We don't necessarily have all the answers. It's more of a puzzle that you have to piece together and just make extrapolations of what data sets we have to explain the past. But in that, there is a creative component that lets you use your imagination a little bit to understand what it was like back then, because outside of the Romans, nobody was taking as much detailed cuneiformic information down as we'd like. So it's interesting. It's fun. And I'm trying to get my kids right now to be quite interested about the Egyptians, because one of my stuffies, one of my teddy bears, was actually the mascot for the Met, which is I think it's a high Egyptian hippopotamus. And it was my first teddy bear that I remembered, and it linked me to the past. It linked me to history. And now I'm trying to teach my kids about the Egyptians, because they love hippopotamuses, they love lions, and I'm trying to explain something more than just the animals of that region and then the history that was involved.
That is wonderful. I used to point out to students when they would, so many students grow up thinking they don't like history. They say it's boring. And when I would point out, you know, it's the story of people. And if you look for the stories of people, then how could it possibly be boring? And a lot of them scratch their heads about that. So I think that definitely we need a lot of teachers like your mom who got people interested definitely in history. You ended up being a political science major in college. Did history lead you into the political science connection, perhaps with the interest in foreign service?
I was interested in foreign service because history is a story of the world, not necessarily one place. And I always enjoyed traveling, always enjoyed different cultures. I traveled frequently as a child. My parents were always on sabbatical and we lived in multiple different countries. So political science seemed like a better continuity of what I wanted to do and slightly more applicable, if that's even possible with political science. Mm-hmm. But it was history, it was economics, it was present day, it was statistics, all wrapped into one. So there was components of everything that I enjoyed in that major, and I saw that as a conduit to foreign service, which is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. So as part of that, and you mentioned in someplace else about having spent some time in the Balkans honing your language skills, and I'm just curious, that did your language acquisition start when you were a child and traveling with your parents? Did you pick it up mainly in college or for the purposes of the military? And how many languages do you speak?
I'd say none well. so again, my parents, we did sabbatical a number of times in my youth, and a lot of them were to Spain right after the Franco dictatorship ended. So I'm not quite sure why they decided that was a great idea, but it worked out well. And we went multiple times. So I did have a chance to go to Spanish schools, and they spoke Spanish, and it was a crash course. And I did, at one point, speak sufficient Spanish. I think that was my first opportunity at learning a second language. Language didn't seem to be as popular when I was a child as it does now. For example, my school, for my then preschooler, they do both Chinese and Spanish, and they start in preschool, and they see the benefit of that. And I don't think that it was quite as popular in my youth. So I feel blessed at the fact that I had that opportunity, because I think that any language you learn as a child helps just map your brain to understand just how to learn a language. Now, I don't know how accurate that was, because whatever acumen I thought I had in language, I feel like it's gotten worse, because I had to relearn Spanish, and it was a traumatic experience. But I did do... I did Slavic languages. When I was in college, I thought for some unknown reason that the center of global politics was going to be the Balkans in the fall of the Soviet Union. And right. I just saw that as the flashpoint in the world. And I figured that that would be where everything was focused. And it was. So I did Czech, I did Serbo-Croatian, and I spent a lot of time in the Balkans physically doing a study abroad. And it did seem like that was going to be where the end of civilization happened, not the end of civilization, I'm sorry, the end of history, that it turned into more of the clash of civilizations, and 9/11 happened, and I went a very different direction, which required very different languages, which are not at all similar to what I'd been studying in the past. Languages are not my acumen, but I definitely have studied Arabic, I've studied Pashto, I've studied Dari, and then going back to professional level Spanish was traumatic.
I completely get that. And I think that what you're saying about language fits in with what you said about education and training, that if you don't keep at it, you lose your edge. And language is definitely like that. I was at one time fluent in French, and now I can say thank you. So there you go. I get it. We have a couple of some questions coming in. I'm going to sprinkle in amongst the conversation here. And it seems like a good time since we've now heard about you studying political science in college. Students at Ranchero Middle School out here in California would like to know the moment that you knew you wanted to serve our country, or that specifically you wanted to go into the Army. Was there a particular moment when you came to that realization?
There actually was sort of a transformational experience that led to the military. I actually am not from a family that has any military background whatsoever. We're also immigrants, so it was relatively recent that we were in this country. But still, no real experience with military personnel. In college, I wasn't in ROTC. I figured I was going to go to the State Department, and that was the direction that I was heading. And while I was in the Balkans, I did realize that the majority efforts that were occurring in the Balkans didn't seem to be UN, European partners, or even necessarily the State Department. It seemed like a lot of the heavy lifting was being done by the U.S. military, because I would be in a small town in Bosnia, and I wouldn't be bumping into anyone else except for the U.S. military. And it just, it didn't change my mind at that moment, but it gave me an understanding that this is an organization that is oftentimes tapped to do things that people don't realize what it's doing. So when you bump into a civil affairs unit in a small town in Bosnia, and you don't see any State Department personnel anywhere because it's considered a hot zone, you realize that this is really the forefront of our foreign policy. And it's not because they're necessarily the ones with the sharp, pointy sticks. It's because they have the capability, the training, and the assets. And that's continued to today. And this is in no way a ding to our State Department. It's just a simple reality of what our capabilities are to push into hot zones. And so that was a moment for me to see what the military did. And when I was getting ready to leave college, I realized that the military did have that to offer. And I was reached out to, and an offer was made that was very competitive, in that they would bring me in to be an officer with what's called officer candidate school. So they take you basically with zero military experience, and in a very short amount of time, they brush you off and set you up to be a military officer and send you off into your career. And 9/11 had happened, and it just seemed like the world had changed so quickly that I wanted to be involved as rapidly as possible. And there's no industry, there's no location even in government that takes you and so rapidly puts you in charge of so much and puts so much trust into you. So even the State Department, it takes a long time stamping a lot of passports to get to a position where you can affect change. Whereas in the U.S. military, they impose a lot of trust on you to take 40 people out into the unknown, and they trust you to do what's right on behalf of the United States. And we're talking about 22-year-old lieutenants that are being entrusted with things that most people in government aren't entrusted until they're GS 14 or 15, so 10, 15 years into their careers. And I saw that as beneficial, and it's exactly what happened. In very short order, I found myself in Afghanistan in a very unique period of history, running around chasing after a 6'3" guy from Saudi Arabia. And that trust would never have been imposed in me in any other organization. And it was just a remarkable experience with remarkable people. And it was a remarkable country.
Well, it speaks well, not only of the country's trust in you, but also, I think, your accomplishments. And then also, I wanted to bring up, someone else had asked you at one point about who served you best when you got into the military, when you went from being that highly, highly educated and well-trained brand new officer out into the battlefield. Who was there for you? And you mentioned the NCO. Would you explain for our audience a little bit about the nature of an NCO and what is the difference between that person's experience and training, so to speak, versus your more professional education and foray into the military?
I think that specifically the United States Army, our culture is different than the other branches. And it just comes down to, we're more of a human-driven organization. We don't have ships, we have people. So the NCO, the non-commissioned officer, what a non-commissioned officer is it's an enlisted person. And there's two separate, for simplicity, there's two separate types of soldier in the United States Army and all of our branches. The officer who was commissioned by Congress, and what that means is that Congress actually passes a law to give you your rank. And you commission out of a university or a commissioning source, and you're effectively your management. And those are who become, from lieutenant all the way up to general, the management of the senior management of the military. And they're entrusted with leading. And then the non-commissioned officer is an enlisted person who came in, let's say, after high school and is 18 years old, and then they spend, you know, 5-10 years in the military gaining experience on how the military actually works, how the Army actually works. And after a while, they are given the rank of non-commissioned officer. And this is a leadership level on the non-commissioned side. And they start off as a sergeant, and they go all the way up to the sergeant major of the Army. And that's a very simple way of saying it, because the enlisted side just generally comes in at 18, and the officer side comes in at about 22. And it comes down to educational attainment at that point. But it's really changed in today's world, because some of my non-commissioned officers came from university and simply wanted to serve the country after 9/11. So I had one soldier come in who wasn't even a non-commissioned officer, who had passed the bar exam in basic training. And he found out he had passed the bar exam. I had another one who had an MBA from Stanford, and I, just due to his rank, had no other choice but to give him a machine gun. I couldn't use him better than that. So as an officer, you are entrusted with everything that your organization does or fails to do. And that's really one of the biggest distinctions, is that you are the ultimate last say. But the non-commissioned officer is what makes you successful. And as a composite of all the fantastic non-commissioned officers I worked with, they are the repository of trust and knowledge in the institution. So as a brand new lieutenant, brand new to the Army, handed the keys to a platoon in combat, I had a non-commissioned officer who had 15 years experience in the Army already. And he was my right-hand man, and he helped me be an effective leader. I certainly didn't know everything, and that's why they give you, a freshly minted lieutenant, a 15-year senior non-commissioned officer to make sure you don't screw things up. And along the way, they teach you. They're honestly one of your best sources of education. Your commissioning source teaches you a major. Your military training teaches you the tools. But really, understanding how it all works comes from the non-commissioned officer. And every step of the way, every officer is going to tell you that they've had that non-commissioned officer that they've leaned on to really develop them. And that was all the way from when I was first coming into the military, and I had a lot of non-commissioned officers who were going to get commissioned as well, all the way up through my rank now. The non-commissioned officers who really are the backbone of our Army, and they really do make it happen.
So I'm sure that while a very small percentage of Americans now go into military service, that there are probably some of our listeners who are at least considering it and who may even be considering whether to go in directly out of high school or go to college first and go in. Would you say that decision might be one that they should approach, considering whether or not they want to indeed be in management, as you referred to, going directly into the service as an officer? Or do you have any suggestions about that?
So I think that it's such an individual choice. A service to one's nation, obviously, there's absolutely no way not to serve your nation honorably in the military. What it comes down to is individually how you want to do it. I think that some people very early on, they decide they want to be an officer, and they start doing that starting in grade school, especially a lot of the people you meet coming out of the military academies, because they are highly competitive. They're the most difficult universities to get into. And they require so much of you, from athleticism to intellectual capability to leadership. It's very difficult to get into a military academy. And these are individuals who are driven from a very young age, which I can say I was not. It's people like that who say West Point is where they want to go. And they know, again, from grade school. Others, they do ROTC. And that's a fantastic opportunity to have your college paid for by the U.S. military. And on the backside of that, they give you the opportunity for commissioning and service to the nation. And that's another way to go. And that's, I've met people who are every bit as fantastic as anywhere else. I've never met one group of people that are superior to the other. Everyone's there for service, and everyone brings something unique to the table. On the enlisted side, I have met people who both finished university and enlisted in the military because there was something specific that they wanted to do, because the enlisted side does offer more of that true military experience. As an officer, at some point, you're going to get a desk. As an enlisted person, you are going to be a master at your trade, and you will continue to grow and learn and be given opportunities to excel at that. But there has been a cultural shift. As I mentioned, I can't say that it's, you know, 18-year-olds who say after high school, I want to join the military, I want to spend 3 years, I want to serve my country. Maybe I'll continue, maybe I won't, but I definitely have now college opportunities. Maybe I want to commission as an officer after 3 years of service as an enlisted person. There are so many different ways of doing it, and the opportunities are so individual that I can't say there's one better way to go. But in a short answer, you cannot go wrong. If I had enlisted at 18 and spent 3 years in the military and been done, the experiences, the maturity that would have occurred after that, and the opportunities for additional educational attainment paid for by the U.S. taxpayer, I could have appreciated that significantly. If I had stayed enlisted, I would have also had opportunities to go to university and continue my education as well. Most of my NCOs right now all have master's degrees. So it's just a different military. They've all gone off. They've gotten their master's degrees. They had their bachelor degrees, and they're enlisted. They're non-commissioned officers, and they had even the choice to become officers if they'd so chosen, and they prefer where they're at. So it does come down to individual choice, individual preference.
What I keep hearing here throughout your comments about both routes is choice. And I think that that's especially important given that we right now have obviously an all-volunteer military. And, you know, I can go back to interviews I've done with Medal of Honor recipients from previous conflicts who got into the service either because they were drafted or because they had managed to get themselves in trouble and only the military service would take them. But I think it's important for our audience to know that that is no longer an option, that yes, you have the choice to go into the military or not, but they also have the choice not to take you. So it's important to be prepared for that.
One of the biggest things that I would also say to anyone who's considering military service is, in today's day and world, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were given a report that stated that I think it was a approximately 75% of the nation's youth are ineligible for military service for any number of reasons. 75% are ineligible for military service. That is a staggering number. And it was a big red flag because it does speak to national security, how many people we actually have that can serve. So that's one thing to consider is it's no longer the Vietnam era, we're going to pull you off the street no matter what. It has actually become difficult. So if you want to enlist or if you want to become an officer, one of my biggest recommendations to anyone is remember that this is an organization that is for national security. And national security also requires that you have a very solid reputation. Your integrity is something that is taken into consideration, and they will look. And unfortunately for the youth of today, which thankfully I didn't have, there are now cameras everywhere, people posting things all over the place, and that is not necessarily something that somebody who wants to enter the military should have. So you have to start being cognizant at a very young age and be mature at a very young age when it comes to who you are, what your reputation is, and understand that that reputation now, with just a few clicks, pops up. So that is one thing that has stopped quite a few dreams.
That is an incredibly important piece of advice, and not just for those who want to go into the military, anybody who wants to go into law enforcement, anyone who wants to go into childcare. It is now often impossible to escape youthful foolishness, even if it was just foolishness, because they're, as you said, it's recorded and oftentimes at the hands of the person who was committing the foolishness. So since you brought up integrity, we're moving into the question of some of the values that line up with the character development program, those that are featured along with stories of all the Medal of Honor recipients, including yourself. And one of the questions that came up was from Los Angeles Unified School District out here about courage, and where do you draw courage from, and how can people act courageously in spite of or in the face of fear?
You know, these terms like courage, they seem so loaded because people think that they're only something that's exhibited on the battlefield, but courage really is an everyday activity. And it's our values describe who we are. And of course, we have courage, sacrifice, commitment, integrity, citizenship, and patriotism. And all of those things are values that people exhibit daily and don't even think about. You can't necessarily write down how many times was I courageous today, but courage can be something as simple as making that Zoom meeting work and just blazing forward and saying, this is going to happen. Or especially with my preschoolers, when it all falls apart, these are things that are exhibited whether you know them or not, but you can recognize it's something that is inherent to your being. And you can ask yourself in reflection, am I courageous or did I not show courage when I should have? And you can start extrapolating from your day what that is. But it's not a battlefield trait. It is a daily trait. And it can be done seamlessly.
Absolutely. Any of us that were ever afraid of public speaking can get an off the battlefield idea of that. I suspect, though, that the battlefield obviously instills in people different kinds of courage than off the battlefield, and that probably goes at least partly with experience. There is a video online of your action, actually, when you were helping your wounded soldier get onto the helicopter, and it's about 4 minutes of raw battlefield footage. And so I would caution viewers that, you know, be aware that it is battlefield footage. I found myself holding my breath all the way through. I got to the end of that and was lightheaded and realized that I had actually held my breath watching that action. You took care of that soldier and you went back in. And you talk a lot about being a soldier and doing your job and going on in the face of whatever's happening and having to do that. Could you address that a little bit for us in terms of maybe of service, of doing what has to be done and putting the job at hand ahead of yourself?
I think that video specifically, I have to go back and just describe it a little bit. That video was recorded by the medevac crew, the helicopter crew who came in to evacuate Sergeant First Class Westbrook, my NCO, my only soldier technically, because we were working with the Afghans. And he had been wounded on the battlefield, and unknown to us, he was seriously wounded, but he continued fighting, and eventually, just due to blood loss and physiology, he needed help. And one of the most remarkable things was this video didn't emerge until years after the battle. It was a video that the medevac crew had come together and realized, because Sergeant First Class Westbrook did pass away later because of battlefield injuries, unfortunately. But they all realized this video was extremely important, and this event had really troubled them, and they wanted to make sure that this video went to Sergeant Westbrook's spouse, his widow. And it's because the video captured a moment that was just remarkable to them, which was that Sergeant Westbrook had walked off that battlefield. We assisted him, myself and Captain Fabio, but he, on his own two feet, walked off that battlefield. And they wanted to make sure that his widow saw that. And I honestly had lost that moment to history, and I just didn't remember. And it was remarkable to see, years after the event, that happened, and then be able to get that video to his spouse. And I think one of the things that people have focused on out of that video, because it was one of the first recorded incidences of a battlefield for a Medal of Honor, was that I gave him a kiss on the head. What they don't realize is I then stuffed him into the helicopter by pushing him in hard. But that's what they focused in on. But what I focused in on was he walked off that battlefield. And Sergeant First Class Westbrook was a Navajo, an American, and a soldier. And having that be available to his three sons and his wife was just remarkable.
I come from a Gold Star family, and I have incredible respect for what you did at that moment, because I get what you mean about it being so very, very important to the family to have a sense of where their soldier was and what was happening to that soldier. And that kind of takes us to the character value of sacrifice on both your parts. You talk a little bit about in one of the videos about how at the moment, in fact, the Pritzker military video, your interviewer asked you, what were you thinking at that time? And your response was, I wasn't thinking, I was feeling. And you've mentioned the human relationship several times, but you also mentioned needing to, as a leader, separate yourself from the emotion of what's happening to get the job done. It's a huge, complicated paradox. Could you speak to that a little for our audience?
Military experiences in some ways are so different than others in the fact that you're on a battlefield and you are a professional. We are not Viscoffs, and we are not just a rabble. I think that people miss the actual science behind military action. And so on the battlefield, especially with the United States, everyone on that battlefield that we send there is trained, and they are trained to do their job, and they're trained to do their job reflexively. But they're also able to go through a series of subtasks to understand what they need to be doing. They are not automatons. They are reacting. They are critical. They are thinking, and they are working as a team. And they know that everyone has the same training that they do, and they know how to. They're part of an integrated team. With that, there is emotion on the battlefield. There's fear. There's anger. There's rage. And as a professional military soldier, you have to be able to maintain those and contain those. But that's part of the reality on the battlefield, is you are wrestling a statistical chance of survival to go from point A to point B to engage the enemy. And you have to understand the consequences of potentially being shot and falling on the battlefield and what's going to happen there. You have to be thinking two or three steps deep. This is chess. It's not just a gunfight. And with that, you have to maintain your bearing. And that's what separates a professional military from an unprofessional military, is the ability to contain those motions. But they are on the battlefield. And I can't remember exactly who to attribute it to, but somebody was asked, you know, were you scared on the battlefield? And he said, hell yes. Anyone who's not scared on the battlefield, there's something wrong with them. And it's true. If you don't exhibit fear, fear is a component of the human condition that allows us to survive. And that's an important one. But you have to wrestle with that as a professional.
The so many things to process here. We just got a question in from someone who teaches in a detention setting. I'm not sure if it's a youth detention or an adult prison, but they asked about the importance of values and honor, even in not the most honorly of places, which I think is opens an opportunity for one of the contradictions of the battlefield, that you are both saving lives and taking lives at the same time. You have any thoughts on that?
If we're talking about a detention center for youth specifically, you know, one of the things that we don't do well as a society is taking children who are veering off in the wrong direction and trying to get them reset, recalibrated, and on the right azimuth. And one of the things you have to remember is young people specifically, they don't necessarily, they're malleable. Their values are not hard set. And they may have actually exhibited courage, self-sacrifice, and commitment to others, certainly not patriotism, but you have to remember their situational condition. And this is by no means saying that, for instance, a gang is something that should be aspired to, but you do see many of these same conditions existing in those groups. And it's because those groups are what offered that opportunity for them. We failed mm-hmm. as a society to reach out to that child and give them a location to do it, or explain to them that, you know, this country is here for you, and you know there's an opportunity to serve and do all these things. But these kids, they're just working with what they have, and oftentimes they are exhibiting those traits just in the wrong way. So just because they're in a detention center, just because they made mistakes, does not mean that they're beyond redemption. They quite frankly just need help re-examining where they are in life and where they're trying to go. I think adult detention facilities is a little bit different. These are people who have definitely had their opportunities, and they're a little bit more hard set in their values. But again, I find it difficult to look at a child who's made mistakes and say that this person really didn't have a value system, because they did. It's just, it's not properly tuned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the people who are in those detention centers and working with those kids and trying to give them to maintain their education, get them their GEDs, and set them on the right path. I mean, it's a critical component. If you look at what's happening today in society, most of our conversations really go back to that moment where those people had the opportunity to take somebody who in the future is going to get themselves in trouble and try to get them on that right course.
That is an outstanding point. And in fact, your idea of context in that regard, if we can make these centers a context where these people can learn, as you said, to fine tune and redirect those values in a positive way, using courage for good as opposed to for bad, that maybe they can be a context that's important. Now, speaking of context, you have spoken in the past of the Medal of Honor being partly about context, about that you were not there by yourself. That, and I've heard that from a lot of Medal of Honor recipients, that a Medal of Honor does not happen in a vacuum. Partly the mere fact that eyewitnesses are required in order to submit someone for a Medal of Honor is evidence of that. And to that end, everybody, of course, wants to know about the medal itself, because and you're wearing it. So some of the questions that have come up are, what did it feel like when the president awarded you the medal? I've watched the video and I have some ideas about this, but I'd like to hear what you recall.
Well, the Medal of Honor, it's such a subjective thing. It's not an Olympic medal. It's not really an attainment award. It's aspirational, and it doesn't speak to the individual so much as it speaks to the organization. And it takes a little while philosophically to understand what this award is, because it's given out from everything for truly excellence on the battlefield all the way down to perseverance in the form of, for example, we have POWs who spent 7 years in detention in a POW camp in Vietnam, and they received a Medal of Honor for their ability to uphold their American values and maintain their dignity and rally those around them to maintain theirs during their internment. and that resulted in the Medal of Honor, all the way to somebody who simply in the heat of the moment decided, you know what, I'm going to sacrifice myself for the good of my unit because there's a grenade, there's my unit, and I'm going to jump on that grenade to ensure that my colleagues can live. It's difficult to say how a Medal of Honor is specifically awarded. I mean, there's a criteria. It has to be sworn statements. It has to meet a certain threshold. It has to go through a bureaucratic process. But at the end of the day, it has a very wide scope of what heroism is, what was actually occurring during that event. And additionally, you never do it in a vacuum. It's always done with others. And I was part of an organization. I was part of a team. I had American Marines, Army, Air Force. We had the Afghans with us. This was actually part of a larger organization. And honestly, it's given to individuals, but it does represent everyone who was there. Part of military service, it's just statistical. You can raise your right hand and say that I'm going to serve, and that's quite frankly the most honorable thing you can do. And you may find yourself in your career in a position where you can receive the Medal of Honor, whether it's posthumously or living. And really all you had to do was just raise your right hand and say, I'm going to serve my nation. That said, battlefields aren't fair. Battlefields are an unpleasant place. You can simply be driving down the road, your vehicle explodes, and that's the end of it. It doesn't mean that if you were called upon to serve in a situation that would have resulted in the Medal of Honor, you couldn't have done it. It just means that that's how war works. So right. I think all Medal of Honor recipients realize how subjective it is. And for the day that I was at the White House, obviously this is just, it's a somewhat overwhelming experience because you're talking about military professionals who sometimes like to be on the quieter end of things and don't like recognition and don't want to be noticed. And now you're thrusting them into the national spotlight, and it's not necessarily something that they really wanted to do. And they may have been spending quite a lot of time looking for anyone else to say, no, but what about this guy? What about this guy? What about this guy? Please don't do this to me. And then you come to a state of understanding that it's not about you. It's about representing all service members, about representing your country. But mostly, it's about representing the people you served on that battlefield with. And when I was at the White House, I had the opportunity to bring together a group of people who'd served on a battlefield together. And we had almost everyone on that battlefield there. And many of us have been in contact, some of us weren't, but coming together again, that bond is still there. It's forged on the battlefield, it's forged in fire. But really most importantly for me was the Gold Star families. I had every one of the Gold Star families for the sons and husbands that they lost that day. Those families were there. That was an incredible experience. Having those families there and be a part of it and see that they actually understood their connection, their continuity with this award. It wasn't about me. It was about all of us. And I think that I really hope, and I do believe that this helped give them understanding and maybe some closure at that event. So it was a very powerful experience for me. Less so the actual fact that there's the president, there's the SecDef, that really didn't matter. It was just those right. who I'd served with and those families.
You know, that leads right into another question that came in about the value of teamwork in life and education and with families, and the fact that you know, here are the families of the people who were your team. Could you speak a little about teamwork, and then we'll come back to the Medal of Honor before we finish up?
Teamwork, again, it's applicable in any environment, battlefield or otherwise. And the collaborative nature, we're humans. We're collaborative. We're not meant to be isolated, though we are. We work best when we work together. Even those individuals who accomplish tasks seemingly on their own, they have a team. They have a support network. They have people who are there to make sure that all the conditions are set to make them effective. Collaboration is teamwork, and it is what strengthens us. It's that alloy that makes us better. And obviously in the military, we train teamwork as the core component of what we do. We don't do things in isolation. We do things as a team. And that team isn't just who's on the battlefield. It stretches all the way back from the ground of Afghanistan all the way back to the United States. It's a collaborative effort, and everyone has to be working together in one direction. And this happens in all organizations. I mean, teachers specifically, they are a team. They work with other teachers. They work with the administration. They work with the parents collaboratively to make their students successful. And it's important to just remember that you're never alone. And if you find yourself alone, you need to definitely reflect on why your team isn't there for you and strengthen that, and strengthen those bonds. But everything that we do is collaborative.
Thank you for that. And you have a new team now, a team of, you're part of the Medal of Honor Society. Somebody from Indiana wrote in and said, how has the Medal of Honor changed your life?
In many ways, it hasn't. And in many ways, it has been just the greatest honor and privilege and hyperbolic experience of my life. I wrestle with two different worlds. One is my professional world, where day to day, it's Will Swenson. I do my job. And it's that simple. And then the second component is wearing the medal and being a representative of this medal. And that permeates into both worlds for the simple fact that I always have in the back of my mind that everything I do is going to be reflected and represented through my medal. And it's something that I have to be very careful of for the simple fact that it's not mine. It's shared. It's shared with the teammates on that day. It's shared with the military. And it's a responsibility. It's a responsibility that comes with some sacrifice, but the recognition and the opportunity to recognize those I served with is beyond the pale.
So many things I could say about that responsibility. I love that you mentioned in your closing words there that it gives you the opportunity to recognize those that you served with. And I hear that. I would tell our audience that while we do not yet have a biographical video of Will yet, and I absolutely respect Will, you waiting till you're ready to do that. But we hope to have one sometime soon, but there are over 100 videos online of Medal of Honor recipients, and most of them talk about the kinds of things that Will just mentioned in terms of the medal is not mine, that I wear it for those I served with, and I want always to have the recognition for all of them. Thank you for sharing that from your perspective. Is there anything you want to share with our students before we let you go today? I thank you so very much for dealing with the technical difficulties and joining us anyway.
I think the most important thing to remember is never give up and just keep moving forward. If you get set back, you can always keep moving forward.
Thank you so much for that. And I hope that when I have a camera that we can bring you in on, we'll be able to do this again sometime. So thank you for your time. I'm going to turn it back over to Ed Webb so that they can give the teachers who are with us today the information on getting continuing education credit for having spent an hour with us. Will, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. And Will, thank you so much. Thank you for your service and for taking the time to share your story with us today. It was really wonderful. We encourage all of you to visit the Medal of Honor Character Development Program online. You can access lesson plans there, learn about other recipients, and more. And thank you once again to Will, to Kathy and Noel, and the Congressional Medal of Honor Society for helping us make all of this possible. And thank you to all of you who attended today, or if you're viewing the recording, have a safe and happy holiday season.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.